You got your Bibles and you want to turn to the book of Exodus. That's where we're going to be, at least begin tonight. We're going to start in the book of Exodus. Get my clicker so we can move. Exodus chapter 13, where we're going to read in just a few minutes. Thank you, everyone, and echo what John has said for your presence tonight. I want to also, as somebody who was there, we're say thank you to Scott and to Melinda and to Laura and Jason for all the work that went into preparing for the marriage getaway. There were 19 couples of us who all were there over the weekend, and it was a great encouragement, and a lot of work went into it. So we're thankful to those two folks, two couples, for putting all the work into that. We appreciate it. This is one of our favorite times of year. Obviously, Tucker walked out this morning and pointed to the window and said, I know what you've been praying for, and so, which of course was the snow, which I'm happy for, and I'm happy, I like this time of year because I love the snow, and although we don't get much of it, it makes me happy when it does snow, but this is also one of our favorite times of the year for Tabby and I because we get to do things like that. That's a picture of our pepper plants right now that are at our house. We like this time of year because it's when you get to plant seeds and you get to see things come up and you get to see life spring forth and you get to see beautiful things come out of such tiny little, minuscule little things. It's enjoyable for us to be able to do it. What used to be called a greenhouse, in which people would, you know, build a nice greenhouse and to start their seedlings and be able to do things. Now it's trendy to not call it a greenhouse. It's trendy to call it a propagation house now. And because it's what, you know, this is what I'm told. You got to come up with fancier words. You can't stay the same. You can't be stagnant. So now, what's typical now and what's trendy is to call these things propagation houses. And what the propagation house is for, of course, is it's some of the, you know, the most amazing things happen inside these tiny little things that are covered in plastic. And that is, you get to see life come forth. You get to see something come from a tiny little seed and stick it in some dirt and get it wet, and you get to see something come forth. You get to see propagation. That's what you do, is you take seeds and you propagate them. You watch one plant produce something in which it then in turn produces another of its kind. But what is important about, you know, you don't have to have a propagation house to do this, but the reason I bring it up is what's important in these kinds of things, and at least in these propagation houses, is that you're not just making seedlings, but instead you're providing an ideal environment for those things to thrive. In other words, inside this big dome of plastic, if it's too cold, your seedlings are going to die. It's going to get cold and they're going to shrivel up and they're not going to be able to survive. But if it's too hot, or if there's too much moisture, then there's going to get mold on the leaves and disease is going to happen. And if there's not enough airflow, and all these different things that have to happen in order for this little dome of plastic to provide an environment for things like this to be able to thrive. And so, in other words, you're in charge of the environment. The reason the environment is there is because you're giving an opportunity for something to propagate, for something to reproduce itself, for good things to happen, to recreate themselves. We're going to talk tonight about, we're going to read these couple passages as we move along tonight that are about propagation, but not really propagation of seeds. They're not propagation of literal seeds. They're going to be propagation of knowledge. In other words, knowledge that has the ability to reproduce itself. But we're not really going to talk about the process of this. We're going to talk about the people that are involved in it, in the propagation of knowledge. In other words, the reproducing of something. And we do, in our lives, we provide these kind of environments thousands of times all over the place with little things. I brought a little trinket with me. This is my stuffed giraffe that sits on my shelf. And usually when someone comes in and looks at myself, they say, why in the world do you have a dirty stuffed giraffe that sits on your shelf? Well, what I'm doing is saying this is something that sits on my shelf. I picked it up out of the mud and insulation in Moore, Oklahoma, when we went down to help with the tornado relief. This was in the rubble of the house that something used to be some little kid's toy, but it was in the pile to go to the dump. This is a little thing that helps me to be able to say, what does this mean? Well, to a lot of people, it doesn't mean anything. To me, it means a lot. It's something that's small that helps be able to create the opportunity to produce knowledge. There are things like, I have candles in my office. I didn't bring with me little white candles that we have burned together. That Bill has probably got thousands of them hidden if he'd have kept them. And when we stand in a circle on top of the hill at Green Valley and burn the candles and light up the whole place, to most people, it's just a white candle. To me, it's producing knowledge of a great memory. It's an opportunity to share knowledge. There are bigger things, right? The reason that we have memorials, like if you would go to New York City, they're not just two giant holes in the ground, right? The reason they are there is for someone to be able to say, why are there two big holes in the ground? And for us to be able to say, well, because in 2001 this happened, and this is there for us to reproduce knowledge of something that's a very important thing. On Sundays, when we meet together in the morning, someone stands up here and talks to us about a great event that happened. And we have two emblems that we take and that we use as tokens of memory. When Jesus said, do this, do these things, and it will proclaim my death. Right? We do this. Paul said, it's there to proclaim the death of the Lord. It's there to help us produce knowledge, to be able to reproduce something that has happened in the past. In our two passages that we've got today, we're going to discuss ways in which knowledge of God's will gets propagated, gets reproduced, in which it has the ability to say, here it is, and what it does is it requires people. And not just people, but people to be able to create an environment in which it's going to be able to survive, just like we do in a propagation house, and we make little seedlings and allow them to be able to grow. We're not going to talk about the process, but the people and the role they play in being able to do that. It's interesting, and we'll just mention this as we go along, these two occurrences ask the same question, essentially. What does this mean? This is what the question of a son is in each of them, and we'll read them in just a minute. It's interesting to note that in the book of Exodus, it follows immediately after the people leave Egypt, or as they're about to leave Egypt, before they even get to the Red Sea. And so it's at the beginning of the very beginning of the wanderings. And you know that in the book of Deuteronomy, it's the retelling of all of this. And it's again, the same conversation happens. And so it's at the beginning of the wandering and at the end of the wandering, right before they go into the Promised Land. Both times, this account is given to us so we might be able to learn. We're not going to answer the question, what does this mean? But we're going to sort of look at the process of how we might be able to engage with this question and engage the people who ask it, and maybe we can get something. Let's read Exodus chapter 13. Let's start in verse 11. Just mentioned to you there that what we have in Exodus 13 is, of course, between Exodus 12, Passover, right? And what happens after that, the crossing of the Red Sea, right? Exodus 12 and Exodus 14, we're going to read what happens in between tonight. Let's see. So Moses, or God, gives the instruction about the Passover, of course, and it actually happens in chapter 12. It's instituted, what they're supposed to do to remember it. And then in verse 13, we're given sort of the instructions about the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. And Moses goes through and talks about, what they're going to, to remove the leaven, and they're going to remember thus and such by this, and you got to do it in this month, and you have to do these many days of abstaining from the unleavened bread, or eating of only unleavened bread. And then in verse 8, you'll tell your son on that day, it's because of the Lord and what he did for us when we came out of Egypt. And he tells them what they're going to do, what's going to happen. Start with me in verse 11, and let's read a little bit of this conversation. When the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and to your fathers that he shall give it to you, you'll set apart for the Lord all that first opens the womb. All the firstborn of your animals that are male shall be the Lord's. And every firstborn of a donkey you'll redeem with a lamb, or if you'll not redeem it, you'll break its neck. Every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. And in verse 14 is where we come across our question for the night. When in time to come your son asks you, what does this mean? You'll say to him, by a strong hand The Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. For when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animals. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord all the males that first opened the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It will be as a mark on your hand or frontlets between your eyes, for by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. When your son in time to come comes to you and says, what does this mean? God's instruction through Moses is, this is how you are to answer. And what I want to do tonight is look at some of the implications of how this is answered. Because this is one of the great questions of life. I get the privilege to jump in here and do one of these on Sunday nights. One of the great questions of life, what's it mean? And not necessarily answering the question, but what are the implications of the question itself and of how we approach it and sort of the passage as a whole. I got a few things for you. Just have three of them as we move through here to think about the propagation of God's will and how it is communicated through the asking of the question. Number one, I think that we can learn when we read this passage and we think about the question, it's obvious and implied that God's will is designed and intended to be passed on from generation to generation. It has to involve people, always. He's given us His Word, and we are grateful, and it produces the knowledge that people can read and be able to comprehend and to obey and do those kinds of things, and God has designed it that way. But far and above all of those other things, God has designed His will to be communicated through the lives of people, through human beings, to be able to do this. He set it up that way. He gave them practices that were to be done. And then quite clearly says in all of the commands, over and over and over, make sure, Moses, that you pass this on to the people who come after you. So from the time in the very beginning when the commandments were given, and then through all the wilderness wandering, and through by the time we even get the book of Deuteronomy, it pretty much is that. Let me remind you again what you have already learned. Let's tell you again everything that you need to know before you go to the land. All of this is involving people saying, here are the things, younger generation, that you need to know. God's will is always intended to be communicated from generation to generation. And this is why we've said sort of already, this is not about the organizational business-like process, but it's about the people who are the actual people who are involved in the passing on of knowledge and the propagation of this knowledge that's been produced in them, who then in turn are willing to share that with somebody else. It says a lot, I think, about how God views His people when He trusts us, feeble old human beings, to be the ones to propagate everything that He needs, everything that the world needs to know. It's why Paul is able to say in 2 Corinthians that we are God's fellow workers. We mentioned it not too long ago. The fact that we are workers, not for God or above God or below God, but the word Paul uses is you're working with Him. You are dependent. God depends on you as people of the gospel, as people of God, to be able to share that with somebody. It's meant for people to be able to share those things. We plant the seeds, we water the seeds, and God, through His power, produces the fruit. And that's the analogy that Paul uses. It's why in 2 Timothy chapter 2, Paul is able to say to Timothy that what you've learned from me, all the things that I have given you and what you have learned, give those to other faithful people so that they might be able to share what they have learned as well. It's meant for people to be able to share with other people. That's the way God has designed it. Commit these things to faithful men so that they might teach others also, 2 Timothy 2. It's why in Titus chapter 2, in the very next book, when Paul is talking about what he calls in congregational life, what he calls sound doctrine. We talked about that about a year and a half ago when we studied through portions of that book. Sound doctrine in Paul's mind is something very different than the way that we often use that term, sound doctrine. He doesn't talk about specific doctrines of church life or other kind of things that we would typically think about. What he says sound doctrine is in Titus chapter 2 is the fact that, hey, you older men, you need to be willing to share things with the younger men because they need to know. Older women, you need to be willing to involve yourselves in the lives of younger women so that they can learn. And Paul calls that sound doctrine. Faithful doctrine of a church recognizes that the sharing of God's will depends on people who are willing to share it and on people who are willing to receive it. It depends on people. It is absolutely necessary for the older generations of God's people to be willing to share it and take an interest in the younger people. And it's absolutely necessary for the younger generations to learn to respect and honor the older generations for the things that they have learned and the wisdom that they have gained, to be able to learn those things. Other than parents, if you remember, we can reach back a while back when Lonnie Jones was here. One of the things he talked about in dealing with young people was the fact that it's vitally important for young people as teenagers to have, I think his number was three to five adults who can be seen as role models in addition to their parents. For them to be able to look to somebody else who is not their parent to say, this is how I ought to be able to live. This is somebody I can look to as an example. And it's the reasoning, of course, is because that's the way God designed it. For the church to be able to produce the knowledge of the will of God depends on people who are willing to pass those things down and pass those things on and be willing to share those kinds of things. That's the way God designed it. And this is from the passage, this is what you've got, is from generation to generation where God says, when your son asks this, this is what you need to be willing to share with them. And this is the information that needs to be passed on. Let's think of another one. God's will is always propagated, always reproduced through an intimate connection with real life. And I want you to think about the story here. Go over to Deuteronomy 6. Let's read it. It's maybe a little bit clearer, I think, when we read it from that portion. Deuteronomy chapter 6. Remember, Deuteronomy chapter 6 is the great passage that we often call the Shema. It is the passage of the greatest command that Jesus calls when he gets to the New Testament, the greatest command to love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your strength, and your mind. This is where it comes from, Deuteronomy chapter 6. And he gives this sort of background for sharing the Word of God with your family in the first part of Deuteronomy, the first part of the chapter, and then down from verse 4 and following what the commands actually are. And then go down to verse 16, and he gives more of this information. And he tells us about what we're supposed to do to diligently keep the commandments, in verse 18, to do what's right and good in the sight, and it'll go well with you. And then go over to verse 20. Again, the same sort of conversation is sort of thought of as happening, of when it's going to happen. Verse 20. When your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and of the statutes and of the rules that the Lord our God has commanded you, then you will say to your own son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs and wonders and great and grievous against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household right before our eyes. And he brought us out from there that he might bring us in and give us the land that he swore to give to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as we are to this day. And it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to do all this commandment before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. The reason why we've said here that it's always communicated through a connection with real life, I want you to think about the question that's asked. What's the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules that the Lord has commanded you? That's the son's question of what Moses said. This is going to happen. Your son's going to say, what's the meaning of this? And his question is about the rules and the testimonies and the commandments and the statutes of what's going to happen. What was the answer that was given? If you notice, he doesn't answer by saying, what we do because God said so. That wasn't his answer. His answer is not, well, the reason why we do these things is simply because the Lord asks us to, and that's just why we do them. It's a lot more meaningful than that, isn't it? when he says, what does this mean, Dad, essentially? What's this mean? Notice that the answer isn't, or it, the answer starts with, well, we used to be slaves in Egypt. And then he begins to proceed to tell the story of what this means. Not literal by literal, not line by line of saying, here's why we do this, and here's why we do this, and this is how we do this, and this is how it's done. And he doesn't give the details of the Passover, and he doesn't give the details of all these things that are going on. Instead, he says, well, what's the meaning of all the statutes and the rules? And he proceeds to tell them the story of life and the story of their own, of how God showed up. After when they were enslaved in Egypt, they said, we were slaves there, and God showed up with mighty signs and with power, and we saw it with our own eyes, we witnessed it, and he brought us up out of there, and we were allowed to go through, and he gave us this land that he promised so many years ago, and then he gave us things to follow, but only those things are only for our good, so that we might be preserved and we might become the righteousness of God. If you notice, he doesn't just say, we do this because... He said to do it. He said, he proceeds to tell us about, it's not about rote memorization of rules, but it's about who God is to that group of people and how he has shaped them as a group of people and how they have been shaped by the lives that they lived and by the power that was shown and by the blessings that were given and the promises that were made, and to be able to say, this is the meaning of this. This is who God is, and this is what he has done for us. And if we're going to come to an understanding of what this means, of what life means, it has to be in the context of what my life has looked like and of what our congregational life has looked like and what it looks like when we are people who are washed in the blood of Jesus to be able to say, this is what has happened. This is who God has been. This is the meaning of what we've been doing. And so it has to begin and always has to have that connection to real life. Think about, it reminded me of in Acts chapter 1, when before Jesus goes back to heaven and before he is sent back and ascends back to heaven, he tells the disciples there that you're going to receive power from on high and that's going to happen. And then he says, you're going to be my witnesses, both in Jerusalem and in Judea and Samaria and even to the uttermost parts of the earth. You're going to be my witnesses. Think about those in terms of the word, the way that we use the idea of a witness. Who's a witness? What's a witness? If you're in the court of law and someone says, I'm going to call such and such witness to the stand, what does the witness do? Well, the witness says, I've seen something. I have information. I've been a witness to something. And some lawyer is going to ask them the question and say, tell us what you saw. Reproduce to us the information that you have that you witnessed with your own eyes. This is sort of the way that Jesus states what these guys are going to do. Go be my witnesses. Be the people who saw me, and then go tell the world what you have seen. And if you go through the book of Acts and you go story by story and you read all of the lives of these people, isn't that exactly what Peter said at the very beginning? He said, we've got the prophecies, but trust me, we saw him. God has raised him up. He is not in the grave anymore. I'm going to tell you what I saw. And that's what they all do all through the story. They are witnesses of people saying, this is what we have seen. They are connected to real life. They are telling their own story of what the Lord has been to them and what the Lord has done for them. Because this is what God has done for us. How many psalms, I've never counted, although it would be nice to count, how many psalms go through and say, give thanks to the Lord because, and then proceed to tell us everything that God has done and everything that God is. It's not just rote memorization of rules and things that we have to follow. There are rules and there are commandments and testimonies and statutes, all of which are shaped and have to be viewed through the lens of real life and understanding this. Let's look at one more, and it's going to build on all of these, I think. Even more than just, so we've gone through the big picture of having to be shared by people, and then shrunk it down even more to say we have to see that it is rooted in real life, and then it goes even smaller in the fact that It begins in deeply rooted in family life. If you notice, all of the story that he's telling here has to do with parents and children. It has to do with fathers and sons and mothers and daughters. It has to do with what parents do for their children. If you notice, all of these, right, there are ways that we might look about or talk about how parents are going to pass the information on. The first part of Deuteronomy 6 talks about that, right? In verse 1, this is the commandment, the statutes, the rules the Lord God has commanded me to teach you, that you may do them in the land which you're going to possess, that you may fear the Lord your God and your son, you and your son and your son's son, right? It's there to pass on from generation to generation. But more than just being in family life, it has to begin somewhere, and there are things that have to be true if we're going to be the kind of people to build on this. I think it has to begin with, foundational to all of this is the fact that a family has to have knowledge of and devotion to God's will in the first place. That it has to be something that matters, and I'm talking to us as parents and to you and to people who are grandparents, it has to be something that matters to us. Knowledge of God's will and what He expects of us as people has to begin with us, and has to be something that matters. And if you read through some of this, start in verse 4. Let's read some of the things. You're familiar with it, but let's familiarize ourselves again. Verse 4 is the Shema, the beginning of it. Hear, Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all of your might. And these words I command you today, they shall be on your heart. Teach them diligently to your children. Talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. Bind them as a sign on your hand so that they will be frontlets between your eyes. Write them on the doorposts of your house and on the gates in front of you. There's a sense in which this teaching has to be overt, that he says, here are the commandments, here are the principles that I have given. You need to learn to teach them to your children. They have to be something, however, that means something to us. He said it has to be in your heart. It has to be something that you're actively teaching. It has to be a part of who we are so that it affects and shapes who we are as people. But beyond that, he said it's not done just by sitting down and lecturing, right? The way that we teach people, the way that we help young people to see the realities of the truth of God is not by sitting down and lecturing to them and listing all the things that have to be done. Did you notice, again, everything that is said, the way he speaks of it? He says it has to be in your heart. It has to be something that you do. And then talk about it. What in my mind, when I read it, I think of, talk about it when you eat dinner. Talk about it when you go to bed. Talk about it when you get up. Not lecture, but talk about it because it's part of who you are. Write it on the doorposts of what you do. Hang the pictures of the Scripture on the walls, right? Do those kinds of things that make it the environment. That's where we started, that's where we're finishing. Do the kinds of things that create the environment in which spiritual information can be passed and in which it can be communicated from one to another because it's part of who we are, right? Be the kind of people, he said, that you talk about before bed or after or as you get up, or that you write on the walls that's always visible for children to see and for young people to see. But more than that, it is propagated. This information is shared from one to another by people who practice it. By people who are willing to not just hang it on the walls and not just have a prayer before dinner, but by people who are people for whom it means something great. And that it's going to change who I am and make me a better person. And people are going to see that, particularly in this context, my children. If you remember, and if you think about, I guess, the direct context of what's going on, by the time we get over to the end of the chapter, Moses does not say, and you shall lecture your children and teach your children everything about the Passover. When is the instruction about the Passover, and when is the instruction about all the testimonies and statutes given? It's only given when the son says, Dad, what does this mean? The stuff that we are already doing, the stuff that I watch you do, the stuff that I see happening in our home, what does that mean? What does it imply? It implies that I am a person who is devoted to the will of God, and in practicing it every day, and my home is an environment in which my children can see it and are sparked to say, what does it mean when we do these things? There's a difference between those, in my mind, at least in thinking about it. helping those people, helping young people learn what we do is done by doing. And it's done when we're able to provide them a vocabulary to be able to express in words, this is, I understand now why we do what we do. And I've experienced it because I'm part of it, and now I'm able to talk about it because I've been able to ask about it. But if you think about, and back, I was thinking, I pulled some of my notes back from when Lonnie Jones was here. One of the things, and it was one of those shocking ones, and it was given on Saturday morning, so there weren't as many people, just a lot of us young parents. He said the number one predictor of at-risk behavior among teenagers stems from the question, do our parents profess things in public that they do not practice in private? He said, if that statement is answered yes, there is a 95%, let me say that again, 95% chance that those teens will participate in at-risk behavior because there is no connection between what is said in public and what is practiced by a family at home. It has to be something that we come to grips with. And I'm talking about home life, and of course, because that's the context, but we're talking about as it expands and the responsibility that all of us as older and younger people have to the younger people of our congregation, from the little ones up to the ones that aren't so young as we maybe would wish them to be anymore, right? It has, all of us have the responsibilities in doing this, but this last idea I think is important. Because we have to be honest about our human nature in all of this. And there's a paragraph here in the middle that Moses mentions that we skipped over. Verse 10, look at Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 10. He says, when the Lord God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give you, with great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you didn't plant, when you eat and when you are full, take care lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. If you notice, Moses is honest about human nature here by saying, you're going to get there, and when you get there, you're going to have a whole bunch of stuff with which you have no connection to building. And he says, don't forget, even though you don't have that connection to it, even though you didn't build them, and you didn't dig them, and you didn't plant them, all those things that you were not involved in the creation of, you're going to get them. When you get there, don't forget the Lord in all of this, because he is the one who gave it. These teachings are done in the context of forgetfulness, of how we as people have a tendency sometimes to take for granted the things that we have and forget the Lord and forget where it came from. And I think if we're going to boil it down even more and think about it into the context of the questions that we're asking, what was the danger? It was they were going to go into a land where there was no personal connection, no direct connection to the things that they were enjoying. Wells you didn't dig, homes you didn't build. You don't have that connection, there'll be a temptation to forget the Lord. It has to be a priority for us as families, individual family units, and congregational family. It has to be a priority to raise our children that they have a connection to the things that we practice and the things that we do. That they are able to see it if they're never given the opportunity to see us as adults practicing the faith that we profess in while we sit in the pews here. If they don't have the opportunity to see us performing those things and ask us, what does this mean? If they're never given that opportunity, then we are severing the connection that they have to what faith looks like. Just like, and human nature can take over, and they'll forget. This is the analogy Moses uses. You weren't there to build it at the beginning. You weren't connected to it. And so it's going to be easy to forget. With our young people, it's the same way. If they only see us sit in pews and profess and never see us as people who practice, then we are cutting the connection between those things, in which they will not have any connection to the work that we do. And there's a temptation to forget where it all came from. And so when you go all the way back out and you think of what Moses, the teachings that Moses has given and that God has instructed us to do, all of us have to answer or ask the question sometimes. We're all in the place where we have to say, what does this mean? Or when we have to say, who are you, God? Or what have you done for me? And I have to be the one to ask the question about my own faith and whether I'm going to be the responsible person to say, okay, I'm ready to start thinking seriously about things that matter, about spiritual things and about who God is and about what He has done for me. And if you boil that, you bring it all back out again, this question again looms large. We have a responsibility personally, and we have a responsibility to the people who are below us in age and in maturity to be able to be ready to say, this is what this means, because it's important to me, because this is what God has done for me, because it's changed who I am, and because I know God, and this is what He can do for you. It's a nice big cycle, both from the family unit, extended out to our congregational family. We've spent time, Bill has done wonderful work in helping guide us through the book of Ephesians and talking about how much of an intimate connection. If you notice, how many times in all of those lessons on Sunday morning did it all come back to something to do with congregational life, to something almost centered all the time about how we interact as people of God in a family. And this is one of those times where we're able to say, here we are as people who not only profess that we are people of God, but who practice it and who are ready to say, this is what the Lord is to us and this is what it can mean for you. And be willing to share that, to be ready always to give an answer, Peter said, to say, I'm ready to share what God has done for me, or in the words of Jesus, to be a witness of the power of God. I hope that maybe it's given you something to think about. And when we ask our questions, what does it mean? And as we finish, as we've just said, there is the question that all of us have to ask. What does it mean? And what does it mean to me? Am I ready to take a step out in faith and say, I'm going to devote myself? If you're in that position, we'd love to help you. If you're in a position in which you need to turn back and answer it again, we'd love to help you with that as well. If you have a need tonight, would you come forward while we stand and sing?